Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, on Nightlife tonight, defending Australia, our capabilities, the threats in the Pacific region, and the future of the Defence Force. With the rise and rise of China, the volatility of North Korea, and an unpredictable US leader, and indeed a US government that appears to be in retreat from our region, just how should Australia develop and maintain its defence capability over the next half century? Last year's Defence White Paper set out the future direction for the Australian Defence Force. Spending will increase to 2% of our GDP by 2021, an investment of $195 billion over 10 years. There'll be new investments in the next generation of submarines, surface warships, surveillance aircraft, and support vessels. The Army will get more firepower and improved protection. The Air Force will operate new strike reconnaissance and transport aircraft. The aim of the game, of course, is to provide a more capable, agile and potent defence force to protect Australia's security over the next few decades. But just how will we get there? More importantly, how will the geopolitical situation change over the coming years? Joining me this evening is John Blaxland, Professor of International Security and Intelligence and Head of the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the Australian National University. John, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Philip, thanks for having me on the program. No, great to be with you.
Yeah, no, it's great to be chatting as well. And also joining us are two former Army Major General, Jim Molan. Jim, good to have you on the program. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks, Philip. Thank you.
Yeah, no, great to have both of you on. And if you'd like to get involved in this conversation too, 1300 800 222. Before we get to the actual nitty-gritty of Australia's operational defence needs, can we talk about the political state of our region, and therefore the state of possible threats? Former defence officials Paul Dibb and Richard Brabham-Smith have said that Australia face an increased prospect of a threat from a major power for the first time since World War II. Are they right, and are they talking about China, and is there anybody else? John?
Oh, they're definitely talking about China, but they're not just talking about China. They're talking about Russia as well. And Russia has, if you ask the Americans, they see Russia as the biggest threat at the moment. In fact, I was in Washington not that long ago talking about this very issue and making the point that from where we sit in Australia, Russia is of secondary concern, given that its actions of disruption are much more noticeable on the far western end of the Eurasian landmass, particularly around the NATO periphery, Ukraine, Crimea, Baltics, Kaliningrad, and places like that. So for Australia, it's very much about China. But it's very interesting. I've been spending a bit of time in Southeast Asia lately, and the perspectives there are really instructive for us when we think about how important China is. Of course, they're closer to China than us, and they, by and large, really want to do business with China, but they're uncomfortable with kind of the pugilistic approach, if you like, if I can use that term, that China is taking to getting its way in the South China Sea and in basically co-opting countries at ASEAN, Association of Southeast Asian Nation Forums, that's generating quite some angst across the neighbourhood. But what's interesting is that while there's been a sense that, oh, Southeast Asia, ASEAN's a broken reed, it's not working, Southeast Asia's being bought out by China, essentially what I'm finding in the research I've been doing the last couple of years, and particularly in the last few months, is that, yes, China's influence is definitely on the rise, but there is considerable anxiety about leaving this space to China alone. So there's a lot of interest in even with the Trump phenomenon of the United States, keeping the United States as closely engaged as possible and trying to make things work as best as they can. I mean, people know that economically the bread's buttered on the Chinese side at the moment, and so they've got to make that work. And it's like kind of echoes of Australia. You know, we're all in this kind of situation where we're actually really loving the trade with China. No one wants to upset that in any way, but we're all increasingly uncomfortable with the assertiveness, with the, that I am big, you are small, get over it, get used to it type of approach that seems to be emanating from China, and that seems to be even stronger under Xi following the 19th Party Congress that happened recently in China.
Yeah, your colleague, John Hugh White, has just written a quarterly essay about the future of Australia without America. This is a little of what he had to say on air today.
What I think we can see in the sort of upswing of concern about Chinese influence here over the last few months and just the last few days is our sudden realisation that America's not necessarily going to be there to set the rules of the game. We're facing a very powerful country like China, essentially alone, and we're going to have to start paying much more careful attention to how we manage China's influence and how we respond to it.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, isn't it? Because up until now, of course, the reliance on our great and powerful friend has been an absolute bulwark of foreign policy since the Second World War and the Battle of the Coral Sea.
Well, that's the great thing about the Strategic and Defence Study Centre. I've got in there, we've got Paul Dibb, we've got Hugh White, and everything in between. It's a really, it's a very stimulating centre.
And there's an awful lot in between.
There is a lot, and I'm in between. I'm in between amongst a number of other colleagues.
Yeah. But can we talk about this for a moment, though, this idea that America, that in other words, and this gets to, you know, to equipment and gear and all of that sort of thing that we will need. Are we facing a future, in other words, where America has vacated the space and won't be willing to help?
Well, look, one of the things that I love about Hugh is he really puts a message out in very stark terms, and it's a very compelling message. He's got a great skill at communicating a very important message about us shifting our paradigms. And he has basically driven Australians to shift their paradigm in understanding what China's rise means. And with the Trump phenomenon, the rise of China, there is grave concern that Hugh articulates incredibly well about what this means. My sense is, however, that perhaps Hugh is in a very clever way, in a very important way, slightly overstates the case to make the case. So when I say that, I think let's think about the United States. It's actually in Alaska, and the Aleutian Islands stretch very close to Korea. Mm-hmm. It's in Guam, it's in Hawaii, and it's got a semi-permanent presence in Korea and Japan. So the idea of the United States not being in Asia is actually, I get the concept of the United States being metaphorically absent, but physically it's not. And its interests are very much tied with Asia as well. So, but of course, the point is that conceptually the United States has effectively been a little bit vacant. You know, while Trump spent the longest time a president had spent in East Asia in many, many years, he didn't actually articulate a vision that was going to actually resonate more than the Belt Road Initiative and the AIIB, the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. What we have, and this is the most compelling, you know, in a reductionist sense, a symptom. You've got a Belt Road Initiative, which is talking about bridging, and then you've got Trump building walls. And that is kind of, in a nutshell, why the United States' presence, even though it is still very, very powerful and very, very consequential in East Asia and around the world, is losing out conceptually and in terms of our perceptions of the world. But I get back to my point earlier, is that, you know, as in the studies I've been doing, no one wants the US to leave. They all want it to stay.
Well, I know they do. I know they want. But, I mean, what you want is not necessarily what you get. Jim, how do you see it? I mean, because, I mean, you make a potent argument, really, that China's expansion in the South China Sea, which has gone essentially unopposed, well, not essentially, it has gone unopposed, and that the onward march of North Korea to become now an effective nuclear state, despite America's opposition, etc., has underlined the fact that America will talk but won't walk when it comes to it, and that does place Australia in a situation that needs some thinking about, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And I don't think we're doing as effective thinking about issues like that and how that impacts on our defence policy. And if we say to ourselves that the centrepiece of our defence policy is is the United States and their defence capability, then if that changes, we must consider changing our own defence policy. And if you look at If you'd spoken to one of the defense secretaries in the US some years ago, they would have described the world that faces us as four nations, that the threat in the world that faces us is four nations and an ideology. And those four nations are Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, and the ideology, obviously, is Islamic ideology. And we certainly need to focus on our region, but our region, the interactions of our region are unbelievable. If we think that our part of the world is the Indo-Pacific, the Indian Ocean and the Pacific, it brings half the trouble spots in the world into our area. And if it's one thing that we've been consistently bad at over many, many years, it's been to predict those that we would go to war with and where the threat comes from. And if I had to put it in simple terms, I'd say that the greatest threat to Australia is uncertainty. And the only way to prepare for uncertainty is to prepare across a wide base and to the maximum that you can afford in defence terms. And I think that's very, very important, particularly as there are two dynamics at the moment. One has the four nations of the world that I believe are challenges to us. Their capability is increasing at much the same time as US defence capability is relatively decreasing.
Yeah, the US is still, of course, a major military power, and in fact, the significant military power in the world. Their capacity far exceeds that of China, for example, or indeed any other state. So they are the preeminent military state, although, as we've discovered in the North Korean case, there aren't always military options states, and we shouldn't assume there are.
But military power is relative, Philip, and it's relative to the tasks you've got to use it against. And those that would oppose the US order in the world normally have very restricted areas of responsibility. The Chinese are certainly expanding in an incredible way. And if we don't ask the question either of the United States or of ourselves as to what the defence output is, what do we have to do with our defence force, what does the Americans have to do with their defence force, you can't say they're the predominant military power if they can't dominate in perhaps two areas or three areas or four areas. And I think the fact that the world is faced by a number of threats, if one of those threats goes off, the Americans can probably handle it. If two of them go off, it's a real problem at the moment. The philosophy of the US used to be during and after the Cold War that they could handle two what they call regional wars, which are very serious wars, not just Iraq, an Iraq-type war, but two serious Army, Navy, Air Force fighting wars and a small war somewhere. They believe they can't do that anymore.
Yeah, John, just back to China again for a second, because we used to once talk about Indonesia as being a threat to our north. We don't talk about that anymore, do we?
Well, no, we don't, because the situation in Indonesia has changed significantly. We've actually had a very prickly relationship with Indonesia, you know, because of
still
things
do,
like
beef,
boats, spies, clemency, Papua, Timor, you name it. We keep poking them in the eye, and that we wonder why they're upset with us and why the commander-in-chief there, Gatot Nurmantio, doesn't like us that much. And we actually need to have a long, hard look at ourselves, because we are extremely patronising and arrogant towards Indonesia. We're always moralising about the challenges they face without really seeking to understand them. But when you look at the way the Indonesians view the world, they're concerned about things north. They're not concerned about Australia. So in fact, increasingly, what we're finding is that there's a space emerging for Australia and Indonesia to cooperate in a way we've never been able to before.
When we talk about China, the rise of China, you know, we've seen it in their geographic expansion in that sense of with the island atolls and the South China Sea. They're certainly taking territory, as it were, although some might say not particularly significant, and they've reassured everybody, including the Philippines, most recently at ASEAN,
we're not going to militarise it, but then they go and militarise it.
Yeah. And also, don't worry about it. Your ships are perfectly welcome. You can sail past.
For now.
Yeah, exactly. until they want to stop us.
Until we say you can't, presumably.
Yeah, exactly.
The
capriciousness of this is very clearly indicated by what's happened to the South Koreans. When they deployed the THAAD missiles, the Terminal High Altitude Air Defence missile systems into South Korea that the United States deployed there, China imposed a blockade effectively on Lotte, the very big Korean department store that's got a massive number of stores across China, and blocked Chinese tourists going to Korea. This is really capricious. And it sent a very clear message to Korea that you are to do what we want.
I think they objected more, John, to the fact that the THAAD radar looked across China to such a frightening extent for them.
Yeah, well, that's right. But I mean, this gets back to the whole issue about North Korea and what China's motives are for going along with the sanctions and for playing along, because it does seem that China is actually complying with the sanctions and seeking to apply pressure on North Korea. My take on that is that China is actually doing this because it's worried that by not doing it, it's actually feeding Japanese militarism. And it can't afford to feed Japanese militarism because Japan is a very high-tech country. It's a very sophisticated country. Economically, it's on a downward slope, but so a lot of other countries. But it does present a very significant obstacle to Chinese ambitions to expand and to dominate in the East Asian space. Applying pressure on North Korea, they're effectively trying to diminish the enthusiasm for Japan to actually arm further, particularly go nuclear, in the face of the imminent, thermonuclear ICBM-capable North Korean state acting on those capabilities. That's a scary thought.
Okay, we can't on our own. In fact, there was a summit meeting of diplomats a couple of years back. You know, on the question of what are we going to do about the rise of China, the answer came back pretty much, well, not much, because we don't on our own have any capacity to do so. And China will do what it wants to, won't it, in the South China Sea and elsewhere in our neck of the woods. And we are not in the position to oppose it or to pick a fight about it.
Well, this is the approach that the Obama administration took. They basically, talked about, telling China not to do something at Scarborough Shoal, which was this kind of, it was in the Philippines exclusive economic zone. It was just one of those kind of borderline shoals, barely above the surface. Why would you bother wanting to fight over it? Of course, China knew that. It pushed, the United States caved, and it set the precedent for what then happened over the next couple of years, which is a series of rapid construction and industrial scale construction of islands in the South China Sea, which has transformed the space and now has left China completely dominant of that space. It doesn't completely, it's not exclusive. I mean, the other countries still have their little islands, the Malaysians, the Vietnamese, the Filipinos, the Taiwanese, etc. But essentially, that space is now dominated by China. It's now got, as Paul Dibb and Richard Braben-Smith pointed out, it's put China 1,000 kilometres closer to Australia in terms of being able to project force. But, of course, in between is Indonesia. But I think there's one point I think I really want to make here. We need to actually, I think, stop thinking just in terms of military capabilities, because it's not about military capabilities. When you think about the Chinese approach to strategy, they don't think about Clausewitz the way we do, the great German theorist and strategist. To my mind, they're much more mindful of Sun Tzu, the Chinese strategist, the ancient Chinese strategists, who described the acme of skill being to defeat your enemy without fighting. And that's exactly what's happening. They are salami slicing their way through the
little by little. Because each individual fight won't be worth having a fight over.
No one wants to go there. It's just too little to bother.
Yeah.
Like the Scarborough Shoal. Who wants to fight over rocks in the South China Sea?
We're not going to fight at this early stage, and China has a right to do certain things. It has a right to be prosperous.
Yep.
It has a right to be a big nation, which determines what goes on in the region. But I think we've just got to manage that from a position of strength. And I'm not talking only about Australian strength, but Southeast Asian strength, US strength, and the liberal democracies in the world, the strength of those. So I think if we just take a philosophy of hoping China will be nice to us, then that's not a workable strategy. We've got to be able to manage China, manage the rise of China, not contain it, but to manage it from our own point of view, from a position of strength.
I think that's fair.
John Blaxland from the who's Professor of International Security and Intelligence and Head of the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the ANU, is with us. Also, former Army Major General Jim Molan. We're talking about the defence of Australia. What do you think, Jim Molan? What should Australia's defence forces be capable of? Should we be capable of projecting force or simply defending the mainland of Australia?
Well, this is the $54,000 million question, Philip.
I think it costs more than that, doesn't it?
It probably does cost a lot more than that. But it's a question which we have failed to answer really since the end of the Second World War because we didn't have to answer it. Because our great and powerful friend, the United States, dominated our region and dominated the parts of the world, we never really needed a coherent defence policy. So when Russia invaded Afghanistan, of course, we bought ships. And we didn't need to kind of have too much of a defence output. And if you look at all the parties' defence policies, they consist of inputs to defence. So they consist of ships and planes and tanks and people. But they don't consider the question you're asking, which is the output. And the only output that should be considered in this sense is, can we win the next war? Now, that, of course, requires the government to specify what they think the next war is going to be,
what do you think it is? I'm not asking to predict a conflict necessarily. What might it look like?
There's going to be a range of conflicts that the Australian Defence Force has got to meet. It's got to meet the kind of wars of choice that we go to at the moment, which are very small forces deployed overseas to work with other forces, and we can choose the time that we go, we can choose what we do when we get there, we choose
and these tend to be special forces capabilities, really.
Well, that's just the idiocy of the moment. That most of these wars are not designed for special forces, but it's been a policy of government for some time only to use special forces, and that's a real luxury, and it drives the special forces into the ground. So that's one kind. What we've got to design a defence force for is wars of necessity, where we don't get to choose when we go. We don't get to choose how much we send. I think that this is a real problem. See, having X number of planes or tanks or ships is very, very good. Being able to spend 2% on defence is very, very good. The question is, unless we define in some operational detail what the Defence Force has actually got to do, unless we link what I call linking strategy through operations into the tactics of what our troops do, you're never going to be able to define what we should have. Now, at the moment, the main thing that defines what we've got is money. And what we say what we can afford, and that has produced at the moment the RAAF, the Royal Australian Air Force, which is just about perfection. The equipment the Air Force has got is as good as anyone in the world.
Navy, before or after they get these new Joint Strike Fighters?
Yes, I'm assuming. You're quite right. I'm assuming that the F-35
will arrive.
Will arrive and will actually work,
which is a big assumption.
People challenge that. But regardless, it is an extraordinary Air Force. The RAN, of course, is the Navy is embarking on a national shipbuilding program. And in some years' time, I think far, far too far into the future, it will produce a magnificent force. A lot of the Army capability is very, very high from the fact that we've been at war for about 15 years. A lot of the low-level stuff is good, but we're probably the poor cousin of the three services. But the Army, Navy and the Air Force are a very small proportion of our defence capability.
Do we have enough people?
Well, I think we're not far from having enough people. as long as we've got the high technology.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just people. It is the national base for what we actually do and what we can do. Can we, for example, refine enough fuel to provide fuel to all of the capabilities that we actually have? Do we have the stocks of spare parts and weaponry? And all of this comes down, Philip, to risk. I've got no worries about risk. I don't expect government to provide the Defence Force with enough equipment to fight World War III tomorrow.
Mm.
Governments are paid to take risk, but my problem is that I, as a voter, do not understand the full dimensions of the risk that the government is taking in my name. And if I'm going to vote for or against a government, I would prefer to understand that risk. And I spent my life doing this, and I have trouble understanding it. So we tend to expect that our voters will vote only in a general sense.
I don't think anyone understands the risk very well, or has had the risk actually explained to them. Maybe
simply it's not stated.
Is it actually a sensible question? I mean, can the risk actually be stated?
Apart from in
a very general sense that no modern state should be incapable of defending itself as an article of faith. But well, is that when, all? Is that all it is?
No, it's more than that. But I mean, this is not an actuarial problem that we can readily solve. I'd make the point though that following on what Jim was saying about the wars of choice, you know, we have actually a boutique defence force. We have at times surged in the two world wars. We surged to, in army terms, an army of 14 divisions. We have barely one now.
Hmm.
We don't actually treat it very seriously. This is only 2% of GDP now. This is a new phenomenon going to 2% of GDP. Part of the reason why it's been a lot lower than that is because we've actually struggled to identify a credible threat. People were talking about maybe it was Indonesia, but as I was just saying, Indonesia's actually never really worried about Australia. It's always been focused north. And beyond that, is it really plausible that China would invade Australia?
Well, can I ask you that question? Because in a sense, Australia almost has a natural geographic advantage here,
Indeed.
What is the point of anyone invading Australia as such?
Well,
apart from access to mineral wealth.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, but this gets back to the whole fear of abandonment that Alan Gingell's written about in his new book, going back to 1942 and the fact that the Japanese thrust south scared the pants off us. And ever since then, we've looked to find security in alliances with the British and then the American empires. And of course, the fact that is now being eclipsed is driving us all batty. We're all kind of out of our tree, and Hugh White's articulating this incredibly well.
Mm-hmm.
We are looking out at the world and thinking, well, what do we do? And what we have basically in this period when we didn't have a credible threat, we've basically, as I say, had a boutique defence force that does a little bit of this, a little bit of that, we've hedged our bets.
And we've still got a bit of that now.
That's still what we've got today. Now, the defence force today, though, is more robust than it's been since immemorial, effectively. Basically, the capabilities of the Defence Force today are unprecedented. We have the most honed, most technologically capable, most responsive Defence Force I think we've ever had.
And the only thing I disagree with John on, or I'd qualify what John is saying, is that it depends what you're going to do with it.
Well, that's right. Mm. And that gets to my next point, which is, okay, so what are the plausible scenarios out there? And there are some ones, and I don't think Russia's a really plausible one. And I don't think, things can catch you by surprise, but things have caught us by surprise a number of times in history. History is littered with us being caught by surprise about where we end up sending troops from Gallipoli onwards. We've gone to places we've never anticipated going, but there are some plausible scenarios out there that we do need to think about, and that planners in the Defence Force, I'm quite confident, think about.
Example?
North Korea. East China
Sea. What can we do about North Korea?
Well, that's a good question. And if you ask...
What should we be doing? The answer is nothing, isn't it? Surely.
Well, no, it's not nothing. We should be engaging, as we are, with the South Koreans and with the United States for contingency planning to rescue Australians initially and perhaps support the South Korean if there is a thrust southwards from the north, which is actually not that implausible. Kim Jong-un has been talking about doing stuff that is wacko. you know, to most rational people. Mm. And people then conclude he's irrational. No, he's not irrational. He's a deeply paranoid, very malicious and rational actor. But that means that there are scenarios there concerning North Korea that are realistic and that have potential to actually suck Australia in, despite our best intentions to the contrary. Similarly, in the East China Sea, the Senkaku or Diaoyu Islands, depending on whose interpretation you take. Of course, we know about the South China Sea. That's been in the headlines lately. So they're just a few of the areas where a miscalculation, a rub point that is taken by a President Trump or a Kim Jong-un or a President Xi as an affront, that, a lot of pundits talk about the parallels with 1914, where miscalculation, effrontery, pride, ego, and self-interest all combined in a witch's brew to suck the world into the vortex of war. These are actually plausible and credible scenarios that could unfold fairly quickly if we're not careful. And that's why, given the fact that there are so many scenarios out there, we in Australia, and you think of Defence Force planners, you think, well, okay, which one do we place emphasis on? And we're still hedging our bets with a little bit of amphibious shipping, with a few submarines, with a few joint strike fighters, with a few combat infantry brigades, a little bit of special forces. That's been kind of the mix we've had for 70 years.
When you say a few, we are supposed to be buying 75 of these things, which is...
Oh, but in the grand scheme of things, that's a very small number.
Okay.
When you talk about the Chinese...
A very expensive number, but a small number.
The People's Liberation Army Air Force, this is like a very, very small number, seriously small number.
Mm. Yeah, okay. All right, let's grab a couple of calls. Mark's on the line. Hi, Mark.
Yes, hello there. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Yes, well, I've been predicting these things since the mid-80s, and they gave different talks, one in Vic Park, about China's rise 30 years ago, and I can't believe that people have just twigged to it. But in relation to 50 years, how about 10? And the point that was made about Indonesia, I've been saying for 30 years we should be embracing Indonesia.
Okay. Well, in other words, Mark, you're on board with a lot of what's being said tonight. Alan, hello.
Yeah, hi. I got some similar thoughts. As far as terrorism goes, my take on terrorism in the modern history is that the most successful terrorist organisations have been governments, not non-state players. And one of the most successful terrorist organisations right now has got to be the Myanmar military. They've succeeded in terrorising over 500,000 Rohingya people out of their homes. And I'm wondering, what has the Australian government got to lose by putting some genuine pressure on the Myanmar military? I mean, surely the Australian government, by doing that, would get some credibility with majority Muslim nations like Indonesia and Malaysia and so on. At the moment, you know, Julie Bishop says we're just deeply concerned, and that's Diplo speak for doing nothing.
For not doing much. Yeah, okay, let's put that put that question back to John and Jim, yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm with you, Alan. I've been advocating the need for Australia to take a creative, constructive role to act as a catalyst for some change in that space.
We can't do it on our own, though, can we?
No, of course not. But you think about what we're good at. We're actually good at mustering the resources of the region. In 1993, then Foreign Minister Gareth Evans played a critical role in facilitating the Cambodian peace solution. In 1999, Australia was the catalyst for the intervention in East Timor. It was only possible because we brought in regional partners. And here's a suggestion for the Rohingya challenge, the challenge in Rakhine State in Bangladesh. Now, I know there's talk about some resolution, and China's offered a three-phase plan, which is really a nothing plan. It's a plan of, you know, nice words, not substantively going to change anything. But here's a proposal. The Myanmar authorities aren't going to take advice from Malaysia, a predominantly Muslim country, nor are they going to take it from Indonesia, another predominantly Muslim country. But there is the Theravada Buddhist neighbours in Thailand who actually get on pretty well with the military in the Tatmadaw, the Burmese military, the Myanmar military. And Australia has constructive relations with all of these partners, and we've kept the door open with the government in Myanmar as well. We've done that for a good reason, and because I know there's some work behind the scenes to try and find space for collaboration. My sense is that there is actually still an opportunity for us to constructively engage as a catalyst for a regional response that will pressure Myanmar to make some concessions that are accountable and that will see this issue resolved. And here's a couple of really important reasons why that's a good idea. One is because last time we had a Rohingya crisis, they got on boats and they went to Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand and Australia, and some of them are still in Manus. We don't want that to happen again, certainly not on an order of magnitude larger scale. The other issue is the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, a proto-jihadist group that is out there that has the potential, with influence from Pakistan that's been reported, of actually fomenting yet another wave of jihadist extremism across Southeast Asia. Wouldn't that be fun, folks? So these are things we need to avoid. We need to actively avoid.
Okay.
I know the government's working on it, but we need to actually ramp up.
Philip, I don't think Alan is proposing that we use the military, and I don't think John is either.
Mm.
But I think we would have to make a decision as to what is likely to ever be achieved. Yes, by all means, try and do what you can, but to expect that we're going to achieve results in Rakhine when Aung San Suu Kyi is not prepared to do anything, when the saint of Burma is not prepared to do anything, and possibly the fact that Thailand hasn't moved is that they've made an assessment of their neighbour. And their neighbour has just finished, I think, what is it, five or six, John, kind of fighting wars of their yeah. minorities. And yeah. the last thing they want is another one with the Rohingya. So it's a big problem, Alan, but we've got to pick a fight that we've got even a vague chance of winning.
Well, they really don't have many people on their side, obviously not including us by the sound of it. All right. A number of listeners to this program, you know, would contact us regularly, Jim, saying that they're very concerned and don't understand why Chinese companies have got a 90-year lease over the port of Darwin. Should we be concerned about this in any way? I know government looked at it before they approved it.
I don't think they looked at it well enough, and I think even the treasurer now, who has the ultimate say in things like this, has put on to the investment board the ex head of ASIO, whose job it is now to formally review when investment proposals are made, whether in fact they have a security aspect and what that security aspect is and whether we should do it. And I believe that the Treasurer, I think I heard him say the other day that he's knocked back at least one request for investment in an area of Central Australia for security reasons.
Oh.
So I think we didn't do that as well as we should.
Is it a worry, do you think?
No, I don't. I got to say, I don't think it's a practical worry. I think it's more a psychological worry.
Mm.
The practical worry is that if the Chinese are going to put $500 million into the port of Darwin that we weren't prepared to put in, if they're going to build a container port there, well, give me a policeman and a pistol, and I'll take the port back for you whenever we need it. you can't spy. There's no point spying from a tall building in the centre of the port nowadays when there are a thousand others and more effective.
Although if a Chinese aircraft carrier decides to anchor off Darwin and says you'll do nothing of the kind, we won't be arguing, will we?
Yes, of course we will. And it wouldn't, firstly, it couldn't do it. It wouldn't do it. And if it ever tried to do it, we could put it seriously at the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, that's a scenario that is so far off the plausibility.
Which is not going to happen.
Correct.
It's really not worth giving any real further thought on. And it's, you know, I mean, Jim's making a good point, but we need to bear in mind, and I completely agree, that, you know, when you think about it, you can monitor what's happening at that pier, sipping a latte at the cafe just next door.
That's exactly right.
It doesn't matter who actually is in charge of it. Mm. It's very different to telecommunications infrastructure around the country. Where that effect is very, very significant potentially. This is, let's keep it in perspective. It's piers, it's concrete, it's in the water, it's infrastructure, it's in Darwin.
The argument that you used earlier was is this also, though, another very thin piece of the salami slice?
Oh, I think, yes, it is salami sliced, but it's a salami slice we're happy to give up. Because there's something in it for us. Now, but this does raise another interesting question about Chinese investment around the world. And when it is in our interest, when it is a good deal, you go for it. But you do so with your eyes open. And it's very interesting to compare what's happened in Sri Lanka, where the Rajapaksa regime invested heavily, had heavy Chinese investment on terms that were very favourable to China.
And they've now been booted.
And now they've been, but not only have they been booted, but China now actually effectively owns that territory because the Sri Lankan government couldn't pay that back on the terms. And so
I went there recently. It was evident that China owns the joint.
Well, that's the thing. So when, and this is something the whole neighbourhood needs to understand, not just Australians, that when you're looking at an investment from China, do so with your eyes wide open and that you understand the terms. Now, if they're favourable, great, go for it. But if they're not favourable, be mindful that China is not doing this because it likes you. It's doing it because it's in its interests. That's like
either commercially or strategically.
Commercially and or strategically, often both.
Okay. All right, let's get to another call. Dave, hi.
G'day. Well, I'd just like to ask, for the activities the Australian forces participate in the world, like in Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria, and patrolling the Indian Ocean near the Gulf there, do we get paid for that? Like, do we somehow get paid off someone?
No, Jim? Don't, Dave. We don't get paid for it. We do it as good world citizens, and we're one of the few nations, in fact. For example, when I was in Iraq, there were 28 nations there, and of those 28 nations, those doing the fighting, most of them sucked the resources off the Americans, whereas we paid for, and in Afghanistan, every bomb that we used, every meal that we ate, every gallon of fuel that we consumed, either at sea or on the land. So, no, we don't get paid for it at all, because we only go to places where we should go and where we have where we see that we have an obligation to serve.
But can I just add here, there's an important qualifier here. Australia does this because we see it as in our interests, and that's because we are a small, population-wise, a small country with a big geographic area. We're actually reliant on cooperation and what the defence and foreign policy white papers have called the rules-based global order. We actually are net contributors to that, but it's something that's in our interests to maintain. And that involves making contributions to deal with piracy, to deal with various other threats that emerge in a collaborative way, often under UN sanction, UN blessing, and with the international cooperation from a range of countries, including China, the United States, and often many of our neighbours. So this is because it's good for Australia, and because our trade goes through these routes, and it's in our interest to keep the insurance premiums down, for that trade to pass unhindered, and for our goods to get to market, and for their markets to get back to us.
Martin texts me. He says, Phil, I don't understand why we or how we let Chinese telco Huawei operate freely within Australia using their antenna on buildings everywhere. Are they a worry, Jim?
Oh, I think that there is the problem, because you can't, as John said, you can't look at a port and you can't look at a telco system and be able to assess it as you can a port. But my understanding was that unlike the UK and other nations in the world, we have made a decision in relation to Huawei that we would only allow them to do certain things and not to get into the backbone of our telco system. I think that's the decision we've made, Martin.
We knocked them back from big fiber optic contracts, didn't we?
Yeah. We did.
And that was the basis for that knockback.
Okay. All right. Rhonda, hello.
Yeah, hi, gents. Hi. I was just wondering, there's been a lot of information lately, a lot said about China reaching into the universities and trying to, influencing the uni students and all that. Plus, is that part of the strategy as well and the tactics like salami slicing and the, building bases in the South China Sea? I mean, I know China's not the only country that does that. But, is that part of it as well to sort of, extend influence that way as well?
John?
I knew that was coming to me. look, I think there's two sides to this this issue. One is that Australia gains enormous benefit from the flow of students from China and elsewhere, particularly across Southeast Asia and beyond, in South Asia and beyond, who send who invest effectively in Australian education. And that money goes to develop our tertiary sector. Many people are employed off the back of that money. And so there's no question that in China and in Chinese groups that are studying in Australia, there are those who would seek to influence and perhaps report back to their guardians, if you like, their overseers on what's happening inside the community, the Chinese community, the student community. But I think we need to actually make a distinction between what China might be doing in terms of trying to monitor its own people and influence the diaspora in Australia. And we've seen that through the control of Chinese media by PRC-owned companies. But in Australia, we find, I think there's a, you know, that a general observation I'd make is that people who come here actually want the experience of Australia. They're actually intelligent people. They can make up their own minds. They can read Australian newspapers. They can hear the lecturers, and they can decide for themselves if they agree with the lecturer or they disagree with the lecturer. Now, while there might be a keeper in the room who might be monitoring what people say, they actually, between their own ears, have their own thoughts. They're intelligent, capable people. So I'm actually reasonably sanguine about this in the university space. I know that the Australian National University, under the Vice-Chancellor Brian Schmidt, has been giving a lot of thought to this, looking to make sure that students are free from being harassed, that they are free to explore intellectually the domains that they are studying, and that external powers don't unduly influence that. As I say, I think we need to be reasonably... these are bright, intelligent people. They can read their own prospects, their own careers, and if they're going back to China, they'll be circumspect about what they say because that's what the side of their bread.
That's what the system. That's what the system is. Jim.
I was just going to say, Rhonda, that the government is looking at, I think, which is a bigger problem, which is foreign money coming in to influence our politics, the act of influencing Oz politics, and agents of influence in this country. And we've seen the Senator Dastyari incident over the last couple of days.
Yes.
I was talking to Michelle Grattan about this earlier, and my sense is a bit more like David Coombe and Valerie Ivanov, the affair back in 1983.
Might think more goose than gander.
Yeah, all more right. Goose than gander, exactly.
Les has texted me, and this one I guess is for you too, Jim. The submarines... I mean, a lot of people said, why don't we simply buy some decent ones? It'll be decades before these things are built and ready. Why are we bothering it, and have we made the right decision on submarines? What's your thought?
We've only got a couple of minutes to go. This is a good 2.5 hour discussion, I think.
Yeah, but
very, very
every
quickly.
Complex discussion is reduced all to a 10-second view.
Absolutely. Here's a 10-second grab. We need submarines. No two ways about it.
We could have bought them, though.
Correct. That's certainly an issue. We need submarines. Whether we need them to rove all over the Pacific is another question, but we do need them to be able to stay at sea for a long, long time. If you build a submarine for the Baltic, you may not need it to be able to stay at sea for a long, long time. There are certain things that can be done by submarines that can, most of the things can also be done by aircraft. Mm-hmm. But when you ask the experts, and far be it from me as an infantry and aviation officer to comment about submarines, you've got to trust the experts sometimes. I believe we're building the submarines far too slow, but it would cost us a shed load of money to build them any faster. The Chief of Navy assures us that the Collins-class submarines, six submarines, have now reached the standard that we had always wanted them to reach.
Contrary to popular view, they've actually been quite good when they're actually working.
Without doubt. And the standard that we've reached is that we've got four of them at sea at any one time. That's out of six. That's a world standard. One of them's for training, three of them for operations, and that they are regionally... they can achieve regional supremacy. Now, I'm not exactly too sure what he means by that, but that's the kind of language that the Chief of Navy uses.
That means he could sink the...
I'd like to think that they could think anything in the region.
The aforementioned aircraft carrier.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Okay, so you think we've made the right decision then?
Well, no, I don't know. I don't know whether we've made the right decision. and only time will tell on that. And this is an enormous decision that we've made.
Right.
But there's a lot going for diesel, just one for submarine, et cetera.
Okay, just one final question about kit then. Is there a weapon that we ought to have that we don't?
Oh, gee. I think that if I had to put my money anywhere, I would put it into ground, what we call ground-based air defence. Mm. I would put money into rocketry, because this is what China has done. The way China has been able to theoretically defeat any American capability is by overwhelming it by the best rocketry in the world.
Yeah, I would add a little bit to that. And we think about what's been happening in North Korea. A couple of things have been happening there. One is cyber and one is ICBMs. Mm-hmm. And there is technology emerging today that is actually cutting-edge, bleeding-edge technology with some of the new missile systems available, particularly for naval-based ones that link to the Aegis missile system, radar detection system, that actually gives us, in certain windows, the opportunity to defend against them. And that's pretty exciting. But the cyber domain is a big one as well. We are as a nation, particularly vulnerable to cyber. We are waking up to it slowly, but it's so vulnerable.
I'm glad we mentioned it, because it's something we ought to have talked about a bit more. But time has defeated us, gentlemen, because there is a lot to talk about, as you rightly said. John Blaxland from the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the ANU, and former Army Major General Jim Molan have been our guests tonight. We've been talking about the defence of Australia. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thanks, Philip.
Thanks very much, Philip.
A pleasure to have your time and expertise.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.